Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Chris McDaniel, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio is
Jason Rosenbaum
and
Joe Manis.
And our special guest this week,
Catherine Hanaway.
You might have read about her in the news recently. Making some waves, wouldn't you say, Jason?
I would say so. I mean, we're looking ahead in this Politically Speaking podcast. We know everyone's talking about 2014. We're going to 2016 today.
Yeah, and as our listeners probably know, Catherine Hanaway was the first and so far only Missouri Speaker of the House who was a woman. And he also was U.S. Attorney from this part of the state for several years.
Well, I got into politics, I think, sort of by genetic disorder, one that makes me volunteer to do things, going all the way back to, being the president of my 4-H club in high school. But in Missouri, I came to Missouri for a job. I'm not originally from here. I grew up in rural Nebraska and Iowa. But after law school, I wanted to practice securities law. And St. Louis then and now, and it's one of the few things we can say this about, where St. Louis continues to be an industry leader, we have more broker-dealers based here than anywhere outside of New York, and depending on how you count brokers, maybe
really?
Even more than New York.
Really?
And so I didn't want to go to New York City, but I did want to do securities litigation. So I came here, tremendous opportunities, including an opportunity to go to work for Senator Bond on his staff.
Yeah, which, that's when I first met you.
That's when you first met me.
So you're one of the many political figures that got their start with Senator Kit Bond. What did he teach you? Because I'm sure he taught you a lot over the years.
He did teach me a lot over the years. And the one thing that stands out for me, based on his very long tenure in public service, is that he taught us all that worked for him to play it straight, no matter what. And that meant living well within the ethical rules of being in government, but also telling people really what you stand for and not trying to sort of nuance all the answers, which at times for those of us on his staff was a little bit frustrating, because if the answer was no, he would tell people no. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't say, I don't know, I'll get back to you. And I think that's why he always had close elections, but I also think it's why he always won elections. But if you think about him, he was in office from 1970 until 2010 with a 4-year hiatus, mm-hmm. not a single ethical scandal in that entire time. There are very few other elected officials you can say that about.
And now he might be on his longest break ever from public service. I think it's because you mentioned the 4-year gap was because he lost the governorship in 1976 and he came back to win. He retired in 2010. I'm assuming he's not going to run for office again. So I think he has eclipsed that 4-year break now.
Yeah, but he's active in Jefferson
City. But he's still
City,
very active.
But we'll get into that later. Well, can continue, yeah. Madam Hanaway.
Thanks, Joe. So after I had worked for Senator Bond for 5 years, I ran for office myself the first time in 1998. And
as a state rep?
As a state rep.
From Warson Woods, correct?
From Warson Woods. I also, my husband and I had our first child that year, so 1998 was a memorable year. Then I became minority leader soon thereafter through a lot of hard work. And for the first time in 48 years, the Republicans took the majority in the Missouri House of Representatives, and I became the Speaker of the House.
I mean, a lot of people on both sides of the aisle give you a lot of credit for the Republican shift in the 2002 election that gave Republicans control of the House, because there's a lot of people who have talked about how you went around the state recruiting candidates. And
well, I'm grateful that people credit me with that. There were many of us who put a lot of hard work into it. But yes, for 2 years, I traveled anywhere anyone would talk to me about it. And we went in one election cycle, the 2002 election cycle, from having 76 members to 90. Term limits had an impact on that. But also, I know that I visited in person with more than 350 people around the state, one-on-one, either trying to persuade them to run or to invest in the campaigns.
Now, it's hard for us to imagine a legislature in Missouri that's not dominated by Republicans, but
It's not that hard for Joe and I to imagine that, but for you and Chris, it probably is.
in 2003 and 2004 was a whole new world. And you were also dealing with a Democratic governor, Bob Holden, who I guess has an office down the street now. And I guess the battles between you and him were somewhat legendary in many respects.
Yeah, I was there for some of those.
What was it kind of like in this new Republican majority, you know, trying to get all these things done that you wanted to get done for all these years, but kind of being stymied by a Democratic governor in many respects?
Well, in many respects, it was great to be that first majority after 48 years because there were so many ideas we could all agree on. And even most Missourians could agree on, because conservative ideas had not had a voice on the floor of the Missouri House in 48 years. Well, you know, even with the most liberal members of society, there's a few conservative ideas they like. And so we were able to go to kind of the agenda that everybody could agree on right away. Now, Holden disagreed, and where he most fundamentally disagreed with me on it was whether or not we should raise taxes. I was against it. He was for it. We even had a special session of the legislature about whether to put a tax increase on the ballot. And during that session, I quoted a country music song and said, you know, Governor, what part of no don't you understand? And he ended up running that clip in his ads in his race with Claire McCaskill, sort of saying, hey, I am the governor who could stand up to the Republicans. As we know, he didn't win that primary, so I don't think I was a very effective spokesperson for him.
Well, then you ran for Secretary of State in 2004.
And got the silver medal, which is awesome in the Olympics, but not that great in a lot of
things. Is there anything that you learned from that race that you'll use when you run for governor into your mayor, or that you, since you already have announced, that you're using now as far as things that you say? Well, you know, McCaskill has said this. There's certain things, because she lost for governor in 2004, that certain things that she learned from that loss that she then translated into her victory a few years later.
So there's a lot I have learned. Preeminent among them is not to run against the daughter of the recently deceased governor. You know, that was the preeminent thing. But also importantly, I honestly think I worked a little too hard and not smart enough in that campaign, which is a very honest assessment. But I just traveled intensely and all of the time. And I think that if anything, I need to cover as much ground, but do more select events. I mean, anywhere two or more were gathered, I was there in 2004. And I think I need to focus more on population centers and, you know, spend a little more time, make sure I'm rested and prepared for big events.
Because, you know, there is a tendency in Missouri politics that people run for something, including Kit Bond ran for Congress in, I think, the late 1960s and lost. And he probably used that race to run for, I believe, auditor. And
that's right. 72.
And there's also, you know, Jay Nixon ran for U.S. Senate, and he probably used that experience to run for attorney general. Or our guest next week, Blaine Lukedemeyer, ran in the same election cycle as you for treasurer and lost in the primary, and that experience has been credited for him winning Congress. So I don't necessarily think losing is necessarily a death knell in Missouri politics, but, you know.
I don't either. And I will tell you that more than losing that election, and I do think you learn more from losing than winning, but even more than losing that election, what I think has prepared me to make a run for governor are the 4 years I spent as United States attorney.
Yeah, I was just going to get into that.
And the 6 years I will have spent since then in private practice, and maybe a little bit longer. Math has never been my long suit. But, you know, as U.S. attorney, you get to see people sort of at their best and their worst. And you have an opportunity really to stand up for all the people. When you're in a partisan office, just by nature of how elections work, half the people are going to be for you and half the people are going to be against you. When you're the United States attorney, the only people who are really against you are the criminals you're putting in jail.
Yeah, you might want to explain just what the U.S. attorney does.
That Thank you, Joe. So the U.S. attorney is the chief federal law enforcement officer for half the state in Missouri's case. So from Iowa to Arkansas, almost to Columbia, you are the chief federal prosecutor. You work with the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Secret Service to prosecute federal crimes of every nature, which are as small as those who might vandalize the Arch because it's a national park, all the way up to and including large white-collar criminal schemes such as paying bribes to doctors to use a particular medical device or manipulating the stock market and everything in between. And so during that time period, when I say I got to see people at their best, you know, sometimes it's very hard for victims to come forward, but they do in the interests of law enforcement. And then certainly you see people at their worst and, you know, meth cooks and child pornographers. And, you know, we prosecuted the Michael Devlin case,
which is probably your highest profile case during U.S. attorney stand. Would that be fair to say?
I think that for a single case, that was the highest profile. Probably the one nationally that's even more well known was we prosecuted Bet on Sports, which was an online gambling company that was clearly illegal in the United States. It was a publicly traded company in England. And we caught the two sort of chief executives, one being a founder, one being the chief executive, one in Costa Rica and one in Dallas, but then brought them to justice here in St. Louis.
So you decided to run for governor. I believe you made your first speech in beautiful Manitowoc County in mid-Missouri. Two questions here. Why did you decide to run for governor? And the fact that you haven't been on the ballot since 2004, do you see that as a positive because you've been kind of been out of the fray in Jefferson City? Or do you think that might mean you have to work harder because, you know, you've been out of the electoral eye for so long?
There's a whole bunch of questions
Let's
start with the most important. Why do I want to run for governor? And the answer to that is very simple. I believe that Missouri is a great state with great, hardworking people in it, but that we're falling behind the rest of the country in terms of growing our economy, creating jobs, creating a future for people like my son Jack, who's in the next room and 11 years old. I am very concerned that all of the opportunities that I've enjoyed, that everybody in this room has enjoyed, are going away for younger Missourians and that they're going to have to leave the state to have the same kinds of opportunities. And so I'm running for governor because I think that that the right leadership can change the direction that Missouri's going so that we're creating jobs and attracting businesses and employers to this state.
Are there anything particular that you would want to do? Let's say like your 100-day agenda or whatever.
Well, it's pretty early to have a 100-day agenda, but the lens through which I would assess any proposal is it more likely or less likely to create a job in Missouri? And sort of a corollary to that would be, does it create opportunity for anyone who's willing to take the risk of hiring someone, as opposed to some of the sort of crony capitalism that we've seen where we're kind of picking winners and losers with certain tax credits? It needs to be a place where anyone who's willing to put forth their own effort and ingenuity and inventiveness, that they're going to want to be here because this is the place that's exciting and forward-looking.
You mentioned that this is pretty early. So what made you decide to announce at the time that you did?
Well, it's funny. You know, Jason said that I made a speech. It was the first speech in Manitowoc County. I'd actually been making a similar speech in lots of counties.
I think that's when the first time people noticed it or something
like
that.
Right, so someone tweeted from there, you know, Catherine Hanaway has announced, which was a great lesson for me because there was no Twitter 10 years ago when I ran.
There was no Twitter in 2007, let alone 2003 and 2004, but continue.
But, you know, I really picked Manitowoc County because it's the epicenter of the political world.
It is. I'm sure Caleb Jones is thrilled
to
hear that.
I mean, to be serious, for many Republicans, it is.
Well, it is the middle of the state. And it does certainly represent a lot of the values held by rural Missourians. And so in that sense, it is the epicenter. But why did I announce early? Because Chris Koster cleared his primary field a year ago and has been raising money vigorously for his governor's race since then. And if we don't get started as Republicans, we will never catch him. And so we've made that mistake as Republicans. The last two gubernatorial cycles, our candidates gotten in, you know, with a year or less before the election. And it's just not enough time to put together the kind of campaign you need to win the governor's mansion.
Now, for our listeners, Chris Koster is a Missouri Attorney General. He's a Democrat. He used to be a Republican. He switched in 2007. Now, I covered him last weekend at Democrat Days, which is the first of a series of regional Democratic gatherings. And he gave, which was arguably his most targeted speech about what he believes in, what he thinks the state should be doing. And one of the things that he talked about was the Medicaid expansion, because he says, he cites the experts who say it would add 24,000 jobs to the state, and he contends that Republicans talk all about job creation, yet when it came to that, they don't want to do it because he said, quote, they want to, quote, spite the president, that it's all about trying to oppose Barack Obama, not about what's doing best for the state. Now, obviously, this is one of his messages that he's going to be continuing to press for the next couple of years. What's your response to that?
Well, my response, and I didn't hear his speech, so I'm basing my response.
You weren't invited to Democrat Days?
I think it's open to the public. Oh, maybe I'll go one of these years.
In fact, I was surprised there wasn't a Republican tracker there, but that's another
thing. But I'm basing my response largely on the reporting. And the reporting suggests that Attorney General Koster is for the expansion of Medicaid as proposed under Obamacare.
Yes.
And my concern about that as a mechanism to create opportunity and grow jobs in Missouri is it's really just a further expansion of the welfare state, a similar expansion to the one that we lived through when Governor Carnahan was in office. And the result of that was, while it was initially paid for by the federal government, it got shifted down to the states. We couldn't afford it and then had to roll it back. And it was extremely painful for those people in Missouri who were counting on it. So I think that there are perhaps opportunities to leverage those federal dollars to provide more health care in Missouri. But anything that we undertake in that regard has got to be an ironclad barrier to the shift of that burden onto Missouri, because it's a teaser rate. It's, hey, here, come take this free money from the federal government. And just a couple of years later, Missouri then is saddled with that. And if you look at the numbers, it would be devastating. It is not the kind of growth we could sustain based on the revenues that Missouri collects now. And let's be clear, the thing that creates opportunity is jobs, is bringing new jobs here, not this business that's already in Missouri getting some tax credits and then this other business in Missouri fighting to move them around. It's new businesses, new people, and then when those revenues come in, that's what pays for public health programs, better highways, better schools. There's a direct connect between those two things.
Now, the other thing that, you know, if it is you versus Koster, that there's definitely going to be a difference on is labor issues. Koster has fashioned himself as this champion of organized labor. He's going to say, you know, they'll pass right to work over my veto pen and whatnot.
Is he going to say that? Because last night I heard that he's saying something different about that.
I haven't heard this, but I think...
Well, he's not for right to work, but I think, you know, he probably is. He has sought to position himself as a conservative Democrat. I mean, that's how he portrays himself. So on some issues, there may be some things on the margins. I mean, what are you hearing?
Well, I'd heard that he said that it's an issue for the ballot, which I think is an unusual position for someone who's running for governor to take on such an important issue that I do think has a big impact on our ability to create jobs here in Missouri.
Well, I think his position, last time I talked to him about it was actually just a couple days ago, was that he does believe that the voters should be weighing in on certain things as opposed to the General Assembly, and that now some see right to work. Some Democrats, because I was at Democrat days, think that if right to work was on the ballot, it actually might help Democratic turnout because labor would be able to organize as far as not – there's labor retirees, there's all this and that, that they think that might help in some of the same ways that right to farm is seen by some Republicans as a way to help that.
Yeah, but, that's why I think he's saying that. But let's kind of get to the heart of the matter. If you were governor, would you sign right to work?
I would sign right to work.
Why?
Because right now we look at the states to the south of us and now to the north of us who have manufacturing bases, which we once had in Missouri. We were once a very – I think we were third in auto manufacturing, maybe as high as second. Almost all of that, those jobs have now gone to the south, and it's largely to right-to-work states. Michigan's now a right-to-work state. Almost half the country is. We need those jobs. We need those jobs to have a solid middle class. And it's less than 10% of the workforce are in private sector labor unions. Why should that 10% of the workforce make it more difficult for the other 90% to get jobs? And that doesn't mean that people can't be in unions. It just means that you won't have closed shops where you have to be a member of a union to get a job. I think that everybody ought to have a right to make a decision for themselves and to be employed.
Now, the Democrats, of course, are contending that actually what right to work would be to push down all wages. I mean, that was the big theme last weekend, that it wouldn't affect just union people, but other people would see their wages go down too. Do you see that as an issue, or is that not the real thing?
I don't think that's an issue. I think that the thing that pushes down wages is a lack of demand by employers for employees. And if we have people competing to hire Missourians, that's what's going to support wages.
Now, this might be a wild card of an issue because it kind of is maybe not what you would expect with the Republican and Democrat, but Attorney General Coster has been on record opposing campaign finance limits. He even voted against it when he was a Democrat. What's kind of your opinion on that? Could we see a situation where the Democrat in this race opposes campaign finance limits and the Republican maybe is amenable to them, or have you been opposed to that as well?
Well, there's really two categories here. Mm-hmm. One is ethical reforms mm-hmm. on gifts and lobbyists buying things for legislators and statewide office holders. Absolutely, we have to have some ethics reform in Missouri. I am very concerned about that. On the other side of the ledger is campaign finance reform, and I have not previously run for office when there have been no limits. There were always limits in the races I've run. What I can tell you about the environment with limits is that people just find another way. I mean, money is like water, and so it goes into, frankly, the nooks and crannies instead of sort of running down the mainstream. I think that having a system that is extremely transparent, so every voter can understand what interests are contributing to your campaign, is better than having a dollar limit.
So that might be an issue that you and the Attorney General may have some commonality on.
It may be.
Wow.
Now, concealed carry, which is another issue, it's already floating around. I thought you might want to talk a little bit about your evolution of that stance. I mean, there's some who characterized you as initially not being too keen on it when you were in the state house as a legislator. Although, in fairness, you were speaker when the House overrode Holden's veto of the concealed carry law.
Well, very simply, I got elected in 1998. My first year in office was 1999.
And that's when the
concealed carry was on the ballot. My district voted 70% plus against concealed carry. when it came up for a vote again in the legislature, I felt like I needed to represent my constituents, and I voted against it. When we campaigned for winning the majority in the House, we were very transparent on this issue and said, if we become the majority party, we're going to make concealed carry the law in Missouri. I supported it after we'd gone out, and I was clear with my constituents, this is what I'm going to do, and they still reelected me. And so we passed it. I supported it. Holden vetoed it, and we overrode the veto, and I supported the veto override.
How do you think it's worked out in the 10 years since then?
I think it's been very much as I thought it would be, which is we haven't seen a big increase in violence as a result, nor have we seen a big decrease. You know, the supporters of concealed carry believe that we might see a decrease in violence because people have the ability to protect themselves. I don't. It hasn't moved the needle a great deal in either direction, but I do think it's very positive for those people who do want to be able to protect themselves and have that sense of security.
This kind of goes back to my wordy first question, but by the time you're going to be running for governor, it'll have been like 12 years since you casted a vote in the Missouri House, and it'll have been about 8 years since Koster has. Do you think that voting records or even the issues that you voted on in 2002 and 4 and 6 and 8 are really even going to be relevant then? Or do you think that, especially as we'll probably get to, if there's a primary, they may be trying to nitpick the certain things that you did back then?
I think you're right. I think Missouri voters are going to be a lot more interested in what we would do for them in the future than our voting records in the past. And issues like privacy and what the state will or will not do to protect people's personal information are going to be important. How we grow this economy, and government doesn't create jobs. It's whether we have a set of policies that really invites people to come here. You know, you look at Silicon Valley and what a boom that's been. Jack Dorsey's from here. You know, the inventor of Twitter is from here. Why didn't he start his business in Missouri? It's not that they had a special anything there other than a community of people who were focused on technology. Well, what are we going to be known for? What are we going to be the community that's innovative?
Well, we've talked a little bit about jobs and economic development. What are your thoughts on the Republican tax cut proposals? Is there anything that you would change within those?
Well, sure. I mean, I wouldn't tax prescription drugs. I mean, that's pretty easy. I think that is the hallmark of the difference between the kind of governor that I would be and the kind of governor that we have now and the kind of governor I suspect that we might have if it's somebody other than me, is that I have led the legislature and I would plan to do so as governor in terms of if there's a bill moving through that I think has the potential to be good, rather than wait until it lands on my desk and sort of say, well, this provision should have been different and this provision should have been different, I'll roll up my sleeves and get in there and try to shepherd it through the process and work with the legislative leadership to make sure that by the time it gets to my desk that it's the kind of bill I can sign.
Now, it does sound from what you've been saying that you share Governor Nixon's concern about the rise in state tax credit programs, so that may be one area, at least on general, where you may agree with him. Is there anything – would you like to get rid of all state tax credit programs, or would it be a matter of fine-tuning certain ones?
Yeah, without getting too far into
right,
the details,
right.
Here's the general principle that applies, which is if we bring the state income tax level down, the need for state tax credits almost goes away because you don't have anything to apply the tax credit against. So I am much more for bringing the state income tax rate down so that everyone enjoys the benefit rather than sort of picking winners and losers.
Now, you know, as we kind of alluded to at the beginning, we're a long ways away from 2016. I remember in the run-up to the 2008 cycle, I was talking about you, Michael Gibbons, and Chris Koster running in the Republican primary for attorney general. So I mentioned that when we had Ann Wagner on the show because a lot could change in a couple years. But you're not the only Republican who's thinking about running for governor. A lot of people are putting Tom Schweik, the state auditor, as a possibility. And they're going to say, look, he can raise a lot of money. He beat an incumbent statewide official in 2010. He might run unopposed this year. There's not a Democrat who's filed against him.
And, which is another theory, which I'll get into in a minute.
And also, as kind of alluding to before, he doesn't have a voting record. And he can just point to the things that he's done in an executive office, and he doesn't have to, you know, explain a lot of the votes. My point is, or my question is, because that was kind of just a wordy explanation, if it is you versus Schweik, how do you think you stack up against him, and how do you prevent it from being like 2008, where it's kind of a destructive primary going into the general?
Well, as you know, the primary that you foreshadowed for 2008 didn't happen.
Yes.
And so there wasn't a real destructive primary in 2008. But look, I'm not going to say anything to contrast my record with Tom Schweig's today. As you said, we're 2.5 years out. He is up for re-election this year. I'm 100% supportive of him being reelected as auditor. I think he's done a very fine job. There are many issues on which we agree. As we walk down this path in terms of fundraising strength, grassroots support, a lot of that will come out as we build our respective organizations, if in fact he does decide to run for governor. And as of right now, I'm the only announced Republican
right.
candidate.
And that's why I mentioned that caveat at the front. A lot of things could happen.
Right.
There might be another office that opens up that he runs for. There may not be a primary, but there might be. So
have there been any discussions between you and him yet?
Yeah, he and I have sat down and talked on a couple of times, and they've been pleasant, candid, direct conversations. We both are sort of that kind of person, and so I suspect we'll keep talking, and we're seeing a lot of each other at County Lincoln Days. I think we were at 4 of them since last Friday together.
Now, one of the theories that was floating around Democrat Days was that one of the reasons that there is no high-profile Democrat who has been willing to run for state auditor.
There's no Democrat right now.
Yeah. Right. I know there's none right now. Is that allegedly? Now, I want to emphasize this is allegedly. That allegedly Koster is discouraging any high-profile Democrat from running because he would like Schweik not to have to spend too much money to defend his office, and therefore Schweik would have more money to run in a possible primary against you. So the idea being that, according to some Democratic operatives, he would prefer to run against Schweik than you. Now, in all fairness, I asked Koster about this on Saturday, and he kind of gave me the same response.
Would you expect anything different?
Well, he said it sounded like very complicated political gossip. So I want to emphasize that this
very
is not something that Koster, but still, there's the talk out there. So I guess, how does it feel? I mean, in other words, I've had other Republicans who've said that you poll better than Schweik against Koster. I have no idea, and I guess I have mixed feelings about internal polls. But that said, the fact that there is a sort of speculation going on, just speaking in general, just as a political tactician, because obviously you're good at this, because that's how the Republicans got the House, just looking, is it smart for the Democrats to have nobody run against whoever would be, Schweik or whoever running for state auditor? And what does that say as far as the condition of the Republican Party in the state versus the Democratic Party in the state?
You know, Joe, I think the thing that I left behind 10 years ago when the last time I ran for office was being a political tactician. and frankly, that's what the last several years in the private sector has taught me, is that people just care so little about these sort of internal machinations that we go through. My law practice is in large measure fighting the regulatory burdens of government. And everyone from a beauty salon owner up through Boeing is spending a huge percentage of what they bring in revenues pushing back on the government. And until we shrink that burden, even if we shrink that burden, I don't think people are going to care about the internal tactics of whether somebody runs for auditor in some measure to set up a gubernatorial primary.
Right. I'm sure people are drinking their coffee and thinking about that. but just kind of as a parting question, you know, 2004 was a great – I mean – it was a great year for Republicans statewide. You know,
it was in terms of outcomes, it was, but it was a very close year.
Yes.
Matt
right.
Blunt won the governorship by less than 1 percentage point.
Yes. The reason I mention that is, you know, they won the governorship, lieutenant governorship, treasurer. They won, I believe, a U.S. Senate race. Kit Bond beat Nancy Farmer pretty easily that year, right. And they strengthened their numbers in the legislature. Since that time, it seems like while the Republicans have done well on a state legislative level.
Well, although 2010 was a Republican blowout
yes.
with Blunt and Schweik.
And Schweik. As far as those state array of statewide offices, it just hasn't seemed to come together except for Lieutenant Governor Kinder. Going into 2016, do you think, regardless of who the gubernatorial nominee is, whether it's you or somebody else, I'm sure you want it to be you, obviously, are the Republicans better positioned to kind of get back on track winning these statewide offices? Or do you think that they still kind of have a long way to go before they get their act together?
Oh, I think that we're going to have a very good year in 2016, in large measure because of the policies at the national level. Because the policies at the national level sort of brand the respective parties, even though the state has become much more conservative leaning. And look, if you read what Jay Nixon has said in his campaigns or listen to his ads, and if you listen to what Chris Koster is saying, even at Democrat days, this is a far more conservative Democrat Party than we saw even in 2000. And that's largely because the state is leaning more conservative. So if at the national level the Democrat brand is associated with Obamacare, associated with a bungled foreign policy worldwide, associated with sort of mischaracterizing what its policies would mean for the American people and having broken a lot of promises, I think it's going to be a very good year for Republicans in 2016.
Well, we'll have to end it there. To close us out, you can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at @CSMcDaniel. Jason?
Jay Rosenbaum.
Joe?
Jay Manis. That's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And do you have a Twitter account yet?
I do, and I think it's Hanaway4Gov.
I believe that's right, and with the 4 as a number, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong, but I think that's the case.
All right. Well, we'll be back next week. Until then, so long.